Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Gareth Kay. Gareth is the co-founder of Chapter and, as he says, a strategist by trade. And that's to put it very, very mildly. Gareth is a person with a very, very high profile in the world of marketing. He left a 20-year career at some of the best agencies in the world, where he'd finally ended up being at the wonderful Goodby Silverstein & Partners, and he was chief strategy officer there before becoming a founding partner at Chapter. Chapter, as I say, is a new type of creative studio focusing on creating soulful brands that thrive in today's world of unreasonable expectations, and they like to partner with pioneers. The type of pioneers that they have partnered with speaks for itself. So they've got a client list including Google, Airbnb, Sonos, Dropbox, Uber, Facebook, and PayPal. So one of those. And as they say, I find this really interesting. They talk about the fact that nowadays people expect more from their brands, and those expectations may seem unreasonable, but they've been reset for good, and they believe that only the human friendly will thrive. So Gareth, welcome. How are you?
I'm very well indeed, Sean. Thank you so much for having me, and I'm now going to completely fly under that rather big up you gave me at the beginning.
Excellent. Well, actually, one of those points has to be said. I know you always mentioned that you're also, along with the glittering agency career, you're also a failed musician. Go on then, talk us through that.
Oh, well, I wanted to be a drummer. I had, you know, probably annoyed every single neighbour in the small town I grew up in outside York. Desperately tried to make it in the music industry, failed with my band, and then failed in the industry part of the music industry, where I had the pleasure of having as my first bosses Fergal Sharkey and Nick Begg from Kaji Gugu, my first two bosses. And decided that basically trying to explain to people how The House of Love was not going to sell over a million copies of an album was really quite a painful existence.
Jeez. And can I say, Nick Begg, I remember he always used to have the, as well as being in the world's worst band, he also had the most offensive haircut in the history of haircuts. Did he have the same one when you worked with him?
It was a new and differently offensive haircut, Sean. It was more of a kind of a wedge cut, but he was a big fan of the leather man kilt at the time, which was the kind of look du jour. So he certainly was, you know, still living on the edge, as they say.
Very good. And was Fergal Sharkey still wearing his Undertones sort of cheap anorak?
If only. You know, Fergal now a pretty, you know, dated, well, certainly at that time was a pretty, you know, everyday man. But, you know, he was not certainly in that anorak. And he's gone on to a pretty amazing career, you know, working for, I believe, the kind of radio industry and the BPI, and is actually trying to do something, some really good things for artists, which, you know, is much, much needed, particularly in the world of people getting 2 cents for 1,000 streams.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, but yeah, I mean, it's a long time ago, wasn't it, when he first moved into radio. And first of all, I think a lot of people were going, like, what? Fergal Sharkey, you know. But yeah, he took it really seriously, as one does, and did a sort of, has done an amazing thing there. And I know, obviously, you've been in the States for years, first of all, over on the East Coast and now in the West. So I know you're in San Francisco now. So go on, Gareth, looking out your window, what's your view today?
I'm very lucky. We've got really beautiful day outside. The sun is shining. It makes you pine to be able to go and spend more time outside, maybe, you know, in some of the redwoods or on the beach. But we're not doing that because we're going to try and follow the wise instructions that have been set by our governor and mayor.
Yeah. I remember a while ago we spoke, and a couple of weeks ago, at that point I think you mentioned that the mayor of Las Vegas had just announced that it was going to be a case of everyone jam themselves back into the gambling halls of Vegas.
It hasn't happened yet, thankfully. I think there was enough scorn poured on that interview to make it go away, but that was one of the more remarkable highlights, or some pretty remarkable highlights of the last kind of couple of months, which was basically quite literally a kind of Hunger Games of casinos, where it's going to be survival of the fittest and see which one killed the least people. At least that kind of felt like the tenor of her interview. But I think, thankfully, that has not happened yet.
Mm. It's funny, you mentioned that whole thing about, yeah, so which casino, sort of facetiously put, is going to kill the least people. I mean, I know one of the sort of, you know, one of the sort of the key sort of manifesto points that you make at the agency is that whole point of, as I said earlier on, about the fact that, as you put it, only the human friendly will thrive. Now, naturally, that was written a while ago before the pandemic hit us. Is that still the case? Is that still where you're coming from?
Yes, I mean, it's still where we're coming from, and I hope that will become more so the case as, you know, the world moves on to its next phase, whenever that may be. But I, you know, I strongly believe that, you know, the brands and the businesses that will do well coming out of this will be those who are truly human centered and are truly trying to do the right thing for people, whether that's their customers or, frankly, their staff and employees.
Mm-hmm. And what about having a chat yesterday with a couple of sort of people that again you would know very well? I mean, Tom Morton over in on the other side of the states, over at RGA New York, and I was talking to him about that. What seems to be, if one is sifting through, certainly the marketing industry press, whereby it seems to be that. You know, the arguments are falling down into two quite sort of polarized worlds. There's what I've termed the sort of the Mark Ritson world, which appears to be, you know what, the advice is nothing's really changed. We've seen this all before. The answer is advertise more, get more share of voice, mm-hmm. as opposed to the other world, which seems to be certainly back in the UK. People like Craig Maudsley at AMV are talking about the fact that no, everything's changed and it'll change forever. I just wondered on those, you know, along that line of polarity, whereabouts, you know, where do you sit?
I think it's maybe a false choice between those two worlds. I think the reality is it is not what we've seen beforehand, nor will it go back to what it was beforehand. And I think, you know, there is lots of evidence that Mark points to, you know, in the past about how brands that spend their way through, you know, economic downturns do come out stronger. This is a different type of downturn. This is not caused by, you know, cyclical issues in the economy. It's caused by a major structural shock caused by a global pandemic. So I don't think we've got the data sets to really go and say that is going to be the answer. I also, you know, do feel that the brands that are going to come out of this are the brands who are actually doing things for people now, rather than just messaging kind of slightly mindless manifestos about times of trouble and times of change. So you look at, you know, what Zappos is doing, for example, where they are trying to have a customer service offering that literally will help you with any problem you may have, not just with, you know, what you could buy from Zappos. You look at what Vans are doing to try and support local skate stores and local music venues. I think, you know, the brands that are kind of trying to give back in some way will come out stronger. I think that my sense is of where they're going to come out on this is it's not going to be a case of it's the same as it was before or it's all new. I think it'll be somewhere in between, where I think there will be a new context that we're operating in. I think the challenge that everyone faces at the moment is just the complexity of uncertainty. We don't know when this is going to end, how it's going to end, how long it's going to last for. And so it's very difficult to kind of, you know, plan into the future. But my sense is there will be a new normal. So I'd probably veer more towards where Craig Maudsley is coming from, you know, that everything will change. But I think it will be, you know, not necessarily a complete step change. I think it's going to be a new type of normal that will begin to exist in. And it certainly won't be identical or the same to the world we left, you know, 2-3 months ago.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, just in terms of the two points you mentioned there about specific brands. So, I mean, Zappos, being very British, I'm not familiar with Zappos, and so it'd be great if just perhaps just just clarify what they're about, and also Vans in terms of, you know, what are they actually doing to help music venues?
I'll give you context. So it's Zappos, they were a company set up by Tony Hesch, actually out of Las Vegas. So it was a link back to the earlier conversation. Tony set up a company essentially that was built around, you know, excellent fulfillment. They were well known for essentially shoes initially, getting those to you with surprise and delight and in very good time with very good customer service at, you know, excellent prices. They were acquired, I think, somewhere between about 5 to 7 years ago by Amazon. But they've always been renowned for just, you know, remarkably good customer service. And what they've done now is essentially broaden out their customer service offering. So you can reach out to them on their social media, on the internet, give them a phone call, and they will literally be like a human concierge meets Google meets assistant, and will try and help you with any challenge that you have. So it's taking literally that value of helpfulness and generosity and just re-articulating it in the context of now. So I think that's kind of a lovely thing that they're doing. Brands, you know, very famous old skate brand. What they're doing at the moment is essentially doing a whole range of limited edition, essentially customized Van shoes that you can go online and basically buy in support of your local skate store, the local music venue. They're kind of doing them for a whole bunch of places. You can, I think, essentially set up your own, I believe, if you're a store as well now, or at least get them to do it for you. And then the proceeds from that will go to your business, essentially to help the kind of staff in many ways and try and, you know, give them some degree of support through these uncertain times. So it's basically literally showing your support for the stores and places you love on your feet.
How fantastic. That reminds me, the complete polarity of that. You remember, again, it must be about 15 years ago now, when the issue of, you know, hyper-personalization really came in, and a skate brand that shall remain nameless did that amazing thing, a pretender to the world of skate brands, basically said, you know, yeah, whatever you want put on your trainers, let us know, and we'll have it put on there. And so someone just went in and said, and, you know, online just went, okay, so I'd like to have the name of the child in the third world sweatshop that made my trainers. Can you put that on, please? And they automatically billed him, so therefore legally the contract had been made. And then they realized what they'd done. They sent back the sort of, you know, an appalled email to him, which he then leaked to the Guardian. Remember, there's this fantastic toing and froing of them trying to get out of it. And he's going, no, you know, I paid for it, so therefore I want the name of the child that made my trainers. You know, absolute genius. Very, very good. And so just in terms of the issue of brands, again, I think it's come back to the whole Ritson angle, which there seems to be quite a lot of sort of suspicion from some quarters that a lot of the activity that's being done almost goes into that world of brand purpose, where there are brands doing some, you know, doing minimal stuff in a bid to try and ride the bandwagon of being seen to be nice, as opposed to those who are actually genuinely standing up to be counted and doing something useful. I mean, again, where do you stand on that from the point of view of, you know, first of all, how can we tell? And does it matter if a brand is doing something good just because they want to seem to be good, as opposed to brands that are doing it genuinely from the heart?
Well, I think there's a fairly, this sounds horrible and it's probably a bit too inside baseball for most people to get, but I think there's probably a link to a relationship between the amount of money they're spending on advertising versus actually how helpful they're being. So the more they spend, I would argue, on, you know, mass media advertising to kind of stay top of mind and say, hey, we're here for you, suggests they're not spending or investing as much in their actions as perhaps they should be doing. So I tend to kind of have always a slight concern that, you know, the brands you're seeing in and out on commercial breaks or, you know, on the pre-roll of YouTube videos, you tend to worry, you know, are they spending the money on trying to look good, or are they spending the money on actually doing something that is good? So I think there is almost that kind of, you know, inverse relationship that you can spot there, which maybe is one sign of that. I think, you know, the reality is, and you know, this has been going on for years now, you know, people have got wise to the games that marketers can play. And, you know, things like Google, for example, have created greater transparency between what brands are saying and what they are actually doing. Now, obviously, we'll talk about this later. There's a whole danger of kind of fake news and misinformation that can come around that. But I feel that, you know, people have all, certainly for the last decade, being able to get a much greater handle on what a brand is actually doing. Do their actions match up with their words? And my sense is that is just simply accelerating now. I think there is a cultural shift towards, you know, people really wanting to understand what are you actually doing about something, as opposed to what are you merely saying about something, or are you trying to make me feel good over something? And yes, of course, there's always a role for those types of things in building some type of brand. But I think people are looking for the there now, more so than perhaps ever before. And it's a case of, you know, do something and document it, as opposed to say something and shout about it.
Yeah. And what about the, I know there's, in my last book, you gave some great, you're very kind enough to give me some great quotes for it. And one of the points you're making there was, I think your belief that there's a in terms of the, just a sheer amount or an extent of brands, I think there you're talking about, from your point of view, there's a real oversupply of them. And there's also, I think you were saying, there's very, very little genuine differentiation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, still the case. I mean, one of the interesting side effects of, I think, the current crisis may be companies looking long and hard at their portfolios and questioning, do they need the number of brands they have? And I think there will be a case, you know, much like in any economic downturn, where only the strong will really survive it in terms of business. And I think there may be, you know, a bit of a reset in terms of the number of brands that are really kind of, you know, quote unquote, you know, out there and really kind of being part of the world we're in. But the problem of oversupply still exists. The problem of a lack of differentiation still exists. And my hope in many ways is that coming out of this crisis is we will begin to see brands really think long and hard about who and what they are and what their genuine role in the world needs to be and should be and what they credibly can do. And hopefully we'll see just a bit more strength of belief and differentiation begin to emerge. I mean, probably, you know, a crazy pipe dream, because I've been hoping for this and, you know, wishing for this to happen for some time. But perhaps it is moments like these that can lead to significant change. I mean, I think that's not just true of brands and businesses, true of political systems, etc. These are the times when significant change can happen more easily than normal.
And can I also, a part of that sort of significant change, or one of the issues that certainly I'm interested in, is the issue of the tech clash that you know, when I wrote about that in the sort of, in my first book in the post-truth business, you know, that was, a couple of years ago, coming off the back of the 2016 elections, when the amount of, all these issues around, as you're saying just now, sort of the issues around truth and trust and transparency, in that instance, linked to the likes of Facebook and the data scraping issues with Cambridge Analytica and all the hyper-targeting people via psychographic profiles, you saw an enormous amount of coverage, I think rightly so, about what was happening there and where did the buck stop. And I think that certainly held a very strong place in the media narrative via those like the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the Guardian over here. Meanwhile, at the moment, with the world, everyone on Zoom, with the social media networks basically bending under the weight of everyone being them all the time, I think there's quite a lot of debate about, what, the tech lash has dissipated and actually we're now viewing these brands in a far friendlier way. So Silicon Valley has become our friend rather than the enemy. I mean, does that ring true to you? Because you're much nearer to this than I am physically, and also obviously in terms of just the amount of people you work with at a high level. So where are you seeing that the sort of zeitgeist around the public viewpoint on Silicon Valley brands in general?
Well, I mean, I've probably got a slightly dangerous viewpoint. I have to keep, reminding myself of this, which is I'm in the middle of the bubble, and we are quite insulated to the way the rest of the world perhaps thinks about the Valley when you are literally part of the Valley. Whether or not you work there or not, you're so influenced by it being out in San Francisco. I don't think it's a very simple picture that's is being drawn at the moment. I think it's quite cloudy. So I think on the one hand, I think people have perhaps put the issue a little bit more back of mind, because there's frankly bigger things to worry about at the moment around, you know, am I going to be healthy? Is my family going to be healthy? How are my friends doing? Will I have a job in 3 months? All those kinds of things, which are just much, much bigger issues than any brand issue will ever be. At the same time, I think there's also a lot of the tech brands, you know, doing at least a degree of good in terms of offering their services, perhaps for free rather than for some degree of subscription, are genuinely trying to be helpful. So I think, you know, Google's done some pretty brilliant work in terms of building dashboards to help people understand the impact of the virus in their neighborhood, to try and give them reliable, trustworthy information. There's some great stuff, you know, for example, that they're offering in terms of being able to give people, you know, mental health screening online, just kind of help people understand, you know, how they're doing mentally in these difficult times, not just physically. So I think there's, you know, lots of good initiatives that are happening. But then you do see, you know, every now and then the issues raise their head, perhaps in a greater spike than before. So I think there's genuine questions around the economic model that has been created with companies like Uber and Lyft, and the kind of, you know, gig economy, and people questioning, is that fair? And is that the future we want to build for society? I think there are questions around the frontline workers, and, you know, how are some of the big companies like Amazon and even Walmart are bringing to this, you know, treating their employees who are doing an amazing job at keeping people's lives going in a relatively, you know, normal manner at the moment, but they're taking massive risk. And, you know, more and more we're seeing stories emerge. I think one was in The Guardian yesterday about, you know, what's actually happening inside those warehouses versus actually what companies are claiming is happening inside those warehouses and the way they're treating their employees. And then you have, you know, issues like, you know, the Zoom issue, where that was seen as being the most wonderful gift from the tech gods for a few weeks. And then there was the massive security story of, you know, what actually are they doing with your data? People doing the Zoom bombing where, you know, children are being exposed to kind of crazy incidents online, all those kinds of things going on, where people begin to question, you know, okay, it's helpful, but there's a whole bunch of danger and risk attached to it than ever before. So my sense is it's a similar picture to beforehand. It's cloudier in many ways. I think there's, you know, definitely some real spikes of good being given by companies using their skills and superpowers to try and help people in this time. But also as well, I think some spikes of people really questioning in many ways the economic outcomes of some of these companies and the social outcomes of these companies' actions in the world. So it's I don't think it's as simple a picture as it's gone from A to B. It's just cloudier than it used to be.
Yeah. If you mentioned just, by the way, the thing about Zoom, I saw yesterday, actually I saw online some stuff that that you put up, Mr. K, that was brilliant. That was the Zoom background gold, the archive of empty BBC sets. So yes.
Yes, I mean, that, it's like BBC finding new value in the license fee. I mean, that is literally absolute genius.
It is genius.
And it's passed that around very quickly around all my friends who have any kind of Anglophile or come from the UK. And I think they're going to be used very heavily. So look, there's a whole kind of, you know, spin-off where people at least are having some fun with those things. But there's also as well with Zoom, you know, you can do that stuff and have some fun and trying to feel like you're brightening up your everyday existence and try and have some change. But at the same time, you know, there's the whole issue of kind of, you know, Zoom fatigue, and Zoom's become in many ways the poster child for that. But, you know, I think everyone's feeling it day in, day out now, Sean, where video conferences are incredibly tiring on people. They're having perhaps effects on our psyches and mental states that we weren't fully aware of because we weren't using them in the duration that we are doing at the moment, and the repetition that we are doing at the moment. So there's going to be, you know, a whole set of, I think, you know, learning which we won't know about, I think, for years, quite frankly, about how that's affecting people. I'm, you know, as a parent to a 12-year-old, I'm really interested and frankly, you know, quite scared about how are our children going to be changed and be different by the whole kind of, you know, virtual schooling system. I think it's quite tough for 12-year-olds who are pretty social beings, but, you know, I kind of, you know, wander past people. I'm taking my dogs out for a walk when they have, you know, children in the kind of, you know, 4 to 8-year-olds, when they are really building their first kind of social relationships and social understanding, and not being around physically other children. It's going to be a very different type of generation, and we're just not sure what the impact is going to be on them and how we can help them. And I think there needs to be a lot of work into that.
Yeah. And on that point about, you know, how can we help them, there's an interesting thing I think that's going on at the moment, or a real tension point around all things tech, which almost links us back to the previous point, and that is this issue of surveillance capitalism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I wrote about that in the first book sort of years ago, and I mean, I think one of the real points that we're all looking at now, certainly in the UK, the NHS are just about to get everyone to start obviously downloading an app to put on their phones that'll link into everyone else via Bluetooth to sort out, you know, the sort of tracking of, you know, who's been exposed to COVID, etc. And there are real concerns now being raised about what happens when, hopefully, you know, we manage to defeat, stroke, whatever, COVID, you know, to all that data, and how do we then ensure that surveillance gets tracked back? Meanwhile, a couple of days ago, I was talking with someone over in Kuala Lumpur, and she was talking about the fact that, you know, quite frankly, you know, this is absolutely standard stuff and has been for a long time across a whole range of Asian countries. You know, so a typical viewpoint, bluntly put, from there is, you know, what's the problem? So I just wondered, in terms of, you know, when you're talking with your clients about and the type of clients you work with, how are you going to navigate with them or help them navigate that issue of being, you know, incredibly useful? I mean, that is, you know, vitally useful right now, as opposed to potentially being viewed tomorrow as something of a Trojan horse.
I think it's a great question, Sean. I think the reality is, tracking is going to be absolutely critical to any sense of mitigation on the impact of this pandemic, and any sense of society at least beginning to feel like it can, you know, get back to what it used to be like to some degree. It'll be different, but to some degree. I think it has to come down to the reality that you have to have, if you feel you are being transparent before, you have to be more transparent than you ever have been about your intentions, about your usage of data, about exactly how you are going to delete this data over time, for example, or how this data is going to be used. And I think tech companies have done, you know, some have done a better job than others of being transparent about their privacy policies. I think they have to get much better at explaining it in real English to people, so that they genuinely understand how it is being used, and they have to over-deliver in terms of making sure that their intentions are good and making sure that that is incredibly visible. So the reality is, you know, you look over here, for example, the partnership that Apple and Google have built to try and, you know, build a similar type of tracking system for people's phones in the US, and that has yet to be deployed. But when it is, there will be significant questions over that. And I feel a couple of things. One is, you know, actually partnerships make a lot of sense at this moment, because I think that might help begin to remove the sense this is being used for commercial gain. I think actually, if you can bring a wide coalition of people together, perhaps that can mitigate that sense of there is one company trying to own all the information about you. And then secondly, I think it is about just being incredibly transparent, but more importantly, incredibly clear about how this data is being collected and how it's being used and when it will be destroyed, essentially. So I think that's going to be the critical thing. So, you know, things like, and I'm not sure if this is technically feasible, but, you know, is there a way where they can do auto wipe on those apps that are collecting that data when it comes to, you know, the time for that tracking to be removed from society, for example, just so that you're not relying on people to go and take actions they may forget to do or not do correctly. And therefore have, you know, their kind of data trails being around for a long time. The reality is, as we all know, is this stuff already exists. It's already there. I mean, the New York Times did some pretty amazing reporting, I think, at the end of last year, start of this year, which just looked at how much anonymized aggregated data can reveal about people and the world that they navigate through. That's already there. But I think in this case, because we are talking about, in many ways, you know, an opt-out rather than opt-in mentality to how this will be applied, to a sense of this is about health, which obviously just raises the bar. I think there's going to be, you know, a real need to overcommit and over-communicate far more than ever beforehand. So the advice we're giving is just clarity and honesty and over delivery of good intention.
Yeah. Very good. Can I ask also another point you mentioned earlier on is issues around fake news and disinformation and misinformation, all the rest of it. I mean, one of the things, again, that I spoke about in the first book and the post-truth business, and again, you were very kind to give me quotes for that around, you know, the landscape in the US. If things were bad, you know, several years ago, then they are presumably and indeed are a lot worse now. I mean, in addition to all the issues around, you know, where you are, you've got a presidential election in a few months' time. Meanwhile, around COVID, we've seen, you know, the swirling of misinformation and disinformation being put into public discourse by, amongst others, foreign states and bad actors. How is that? How is that mess being sorted as you begin to, as things like the presidential election, electioneering is, you know, really, really, you know, red hot? Where do people go for you know, trustworthy information right now?
It is still a burning issue.
There's a question.
And the answer is there isn't somewhere. You mean, I would say, you know, you go to trusted news sources like you always have done, where they do things like, you know, double sourcing, etc. You know, so I still am an avid reader in the US of The Guardian, because I believe there is a mission and, frankly, a commercial structure there that will allow the truth to always, you know, be out. And I think that's, you know, still something I always kind of point to. The challenge now is that I think it was a really interesting piece of research that I saw about 3 weeks ago, which had essentially a piece of analysis around Fox News versus non-Fox News watchers, and what was their, both their attitudes towards the pandemic crisis, but also the infection rates amongst those. And it was quite telling. Even worse still was if you actually began to go and pass the shows and, you know, for example, look at those who watch Hannity versus those who watch Tucker Carlson. As much as I don't agree with 99% of what Tucker Carlson says, at least he was relatively straight up about, you know, this pandemic and its seriousness and what needed to be done. And again, you know, a significant delta that emerged between those who watched Hannity versus those who only watched Tucker Carlson. So there is, you know, a real sign of, you know, if you live inside a certain news bubble, and it's very hard to get out of them once you get into them, then, you know, they can have significant outcomes, not just on your political beliefs and the reinforcement of those political beliefs and maybe the ability to polarize those even further, but frankly on, you know, public health, because the reality is those people move in society. They are not stuck in an echo chamber in the real world. So that's, you know, I think was a bigger problem than ever beforehand. I honestly don't know what the answer is at the moment. There is, I think, good work being done, for example, again, by Google, are working really hard to make sure that the information that comes, that they present on COVID-19 is from trusted sources and is factually correct. But it's not opinion, that it is as much as possible correct, true information. I think that's going to be helpful to a large swathe of the population where, you know, people are obviously turning to something like Google to try and get information when they are trying to understand the symptoms or the impact of this pandemic. So I think that is one sign of light, perhaps, in a rather bleak picture. I think, you know, we've already seen the impact the fake news can frankly have on presidential decision-making or proclamations, because he listens to a certain type of press and will be influenced by certain types of opinion groups as opposed to others. And, you know, an increase in still, sadly, a mistrust of experts. But, you know, there is some kind of deep state agenda that's driving them, which is, you know, as I don't believe is the case, to be quite frank. So I think there is just, if it's not going to be something that's going to be fixed overnight, there is a mistrust which has been built over decades of experts and science and facts and truth and a kind of a service of opinions that feel convenient to your situation in life. And you're not going to be able to undo, you know, 4 decades of that overnight, even in a time of crisis like this. I think we maybe can make greater strides and progress than before, but it's not going to be done overnight. And this is a long-term issue that's come to a head, that's been accelerated in terms of its reach by technology, but it's not a new issue. It's one that's been around for decades.
Yeah. And it's funny, just on that, one of the points you're making just now, there's a great quote the other day, and I mentioned this elsewhere, of written by David Aranovich, the excellent journalist, obviously, and he wrote a wonderful line summing up Mr. Trump, which was that he's been running a catastrophic war against reality. Yeah. So, catastrophic one-man war against reality. Phenomenal. By the way, just on the point about categorization and all the rest of it, King's College London did a really interesting piece when they were looking at attitudes towards the lockdown. And they had people basically that they measured to split into three routes. It was basically the resistors, the acceptors, and the suffering. And so the resistors were essentially, you know, just what on earth are they doing, this is outrageous, you know. The accepting, obviously, and the suffering were, you know, you just got to put up with it. And again, it's very interesting when they then broke that down into voting patterns in terms of UK politics, but then also attitudes towards Brexit. And it was incredibly is it fairly obvious where people like Mr. Nigel Farage sat on that whole route. And we all saw over here the images in the US. Can I just say that mad, or we portrayed it as mad, as being the some of the protesters that were demanding to be, to have the lockdown lifted. You know, they were sort of almost like assaulting the town hall with weapons, you know, demanding their freedom to be infected. You know,
honestly, that was the most jaw-dropping moment, I think, of the last 2 months, was just seeing that. And I mean, look, you understand the frustration that people have, and you understand that people's livelihoods are being dramatically altered, in some cases destroyed, you know, and it's horrific. The unemployment rates are, you know, frankly frightening at the moment. But there is just a reality, which is there is good science about this, and this unfortunately is the best strategy we have right now, without real kind of therapeutics, without any sense of a vaccine at the moment. This is unfortunately the best strategy we have. And I think, you know, the frustration is at perhaps the way the government is moving, as opposed to perhaps being a bit bolder and thinking about things like some degree of universal basic income in moments of crisis. Unfortunately, I think the model they decided to use in the US, where there was payments going to small businesses to try and guarantee jobs, there was some, you know, I think as Scott Galloway has quite been very vocal about, that's going to be a huge hot mess of fraud allegations for the next few years, because there's just some really shady dealing going on about how about those funds are being used. And again, it's that kind of weird, I think, muscle memory, or just, you know, default behavior in the US, which is, we will solve this problem through business, as opposed to, why not going straight to the individual and trying to help them? And it's just part of, you know, the way that the American psyche has always been, but has really kind of morphed over, I think, the last few decades, kind of looking at the long historical political landscape. It's moved from a sense of, you know, society and trying to help individuals together, to using business as kind of the mechanism to solve ills. And sometimes it can do that, but it can't be the only way to do it. And I just wish, again, there was just, you know, bolder action being taken in terms of, do we consider something like some form of universal basic income, even if it's just at times of crisis like this, that needs to be taken. And there's sadly a real lack of bravery, I believe, at the moment inside, you know, DC, which I think you're seeing across some of the world's, across a lot of the world's stages at the moment, which is getting in the way, I think, of perhaps some better outcome, at least from a kind of an economic and social standpoint.
Yeah. And also, one of the other things that that I think is, again, absolutely center stage, or should I say has been slightly bumped off center stage at the moment, is the issue here of all things that link to the world of sustainability in all of its forms. You know, I've mentioned in a couple of these podcasts about, you know, of the many things you could quote. There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal recently. The headline was, "Sustainability was corporate America's buzzword. This crisis changes that." And they're saying there about sustainability and all things green being pushed completely to one side. And the great issue there is, will that come back on track? Or quite frankly, is there a perception that we've got other things that take priority for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think it is obviously, like I think all issues, it's taken a back seat to this one at the moment. I think that's in many ways understandable, at least in the short term, because there is a clear and present danger that, you know, needs to be addressed. But the reality is, if you look at kind of, you know, a lot of what the scientists are talking about at the moment, as, you know, the environment becomes more unstable and continues to be degraded, there's going to be far greater risk of more of these pandemics happening. If you think about the impact that, you know, environmental damage is going to have on people's lives and the economy, this is a taste of that. So in many ways, you know, I guess you have to be hopeful that perhaps once we get past the clear and present danger, there is an appetite for significant change. There's a really lovely article in the Financial Times by Arundhati Roy, the novelist, about a month ago. And I think the headline for it was something like, let's use this crisis as a portal towards a better way of doing things. Something along those kind of lines. But his point was, you know, we can get through this crisis and then try and go back to where we were, or we could use this as actually a way to get us to a better set of behaviors and actually make it a step change in the way that as a society we operate. And I guess my, you know, optimistic hope is that maybe we will see this as a portal to a better way of doing things. And maybe our decision criteria and maybe the kind of, I guess, breadth of perspective we're trying to bring onto problems will be broadened by what we're going through at the moment. I mean, maybe I'm going to be completely, you know, wrong. It would not surprise me, but I have to hope that maybe this could be a moment where we use this as a way to actually get really serious about the challenges we're facing as a population. And that is obviously environment is number one amongst those.
Can I say, just moving away from that, I thought was absolutely fascinating. What about the, again, you're talking about sort of different sectors and different, you know, brand types and industries and all the rest of it. And we, it's clear, as you're saying, that they're going to be, to put it bluntly, they're going to be sort of, you know, business winners and business losers coming out of this. That it's very clear some sectors, you know, basically, you're, if you're Mr. Bezos running Amazon, then you've just, you know, you're worth a lot more this second than you were last second. If you're running an airline, then things are fairly appalling. And obviously, there's a huge ecological issue that links into whether that should be applauded or not. But what about the other day? I was doing a thing with the Network One. You know, who link up. You know, I think they've got more independent agencies linking with them than any other network. And one of the key points that they were making when we had people linking into that Zoom chat from literally, I think, about 40 countries, was that in today's environment, it's tougher than ever to be an independent operator, and in this instance, independent agency. So, I mean, you know, the other day, The Economist is saying that, you know, out of this is going to, they were saying it's going to come, you know, three things: faster adoption of technology, the shrinking of supply chains, so they're becoming more national based, and then, you know, effectively big government and big business becoming bigger. So where does that leave in the marketing terms? I mean, how are small agencies going to be fighting their way through this when there's chaos out there? And you know, one of those, I mean, it just seems absolutely bonkers. I mean, you know, there's a lot of debate there. Do people just hunker down and just wait for better times? Or quite frankly, do they sort of, you know, do they copy some of the brands out there, and do they link up with competitors and, seek sort of a strength in that way? Where if you were advising other, you know, agency types, where are you coming from on this?
Well, we feel the pain. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, as a as a small business, you feel the pain every day, and there's more concern about the health of the business than you've ever had. And that's, it's that weird thing, Sean. I think there's a tension where I think the medium to long-term prognosis is actually very good for independent, smallish agencies. I think clients are genuinely beginning to see the value of, you know, a low overhead, high talent, high experience offering more than ever. The problem is you've got to get through this moment in time, and simply you're not just sat on the cash reserves that bigger companies have. You haven't got perhaps the fat that, you know, you can cut back in your service offering to try and bring your costs down and under control. It's really difficult to get through now. So in the short term, I think we're already seeing signs of this, is greater partnership and collaboration between companies, and trying to roll up complementary skill sets to go and build, you know, richer offerings for clients. So, you know, we, for example, have, you know, done a couple of, you know, exploratory kind of projects and conversations with a really great kind of production company based out in the East Bay, in the Bay Area. We've talked to a bunch of different types of companies to explore potentials of working together on projects. I think there's more openness towards collaboration than there was even a couple of months ago, and it's surely been quite healthy then. But I also think as well, there's a real desire to help one another out as well. So if there's projects that you can't take on, I think more so than ever, you're trying to help your friends out by, you know, recommending them and getting them involved early on to take on an opportunity, because I think it's that case of, you know, we're going to be stronger together. And that's, you need to have some of that to try and get you through this kind of short-term pain. I do believe, though, that the medium to long-term outlook for, you know, small, highly experienced, highly talented creative companies is a very bright future. The place I would not like to be is to be kind of in the middle, where you're kind of that awkward size, where you haven't got necessarily the kind of big, you know, network offering that some of the large companies can offer. But nor do you have the kind of density of experience and talent that smaller companies can offer. And I think those companies in the middle might get run over in both directions, is my hunch in the longer term. But we've got to get through this moment. We've got to get through this moment, and it's not easy.
Yeah. It's interesting that point you're making there about stronger together, because that's exactly the point that that network, one we're putting out, you know, to all of the agencies that link into that network, and the point that the line that they came out there was global agency networks are neither well designed for original thinking, nor are they particularly well designed for local customization. Precisely the things that a lot of brands are utterly obsessed with.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's an incorrect hypothesis by any means. You know, obviously it's a generalization. I'm sure there are exceptions to the rule, but I think that is I think that's a perfectly good hypothesis at the moment. And certainly, you know, we built this company on the belief of the power of networks, and actually, you know, building very transparent collaboration with other companies and individuals to help us have the best talent for the task at the right time. And that was something, you know, we were obsessed by, because we saw the failings of the current offering in being able to offer that, and actually behaving more like, frankly, a talent agency like CAA, where, you know, you can give people access to the best talent that they need to go and do the thing they need to do. And unfortunately, you know, agencies used to be brilliant at that. I think they're less good at that now than they were.
And then utterly different thing. I mean, I know that you are a music obsessive, Mr. K. You seem to be before this, you seem to be sort of seeing bands on a sort of almost continual basis. I mean, and this really is a complete left field question, but what is going to happen now to all those local music venues when one of the things that we're being told, you know, by governments around the world, is one of the last bunches of places that are going to be reopening are going to be, if I was back in the UK, you know, pubs and local cafes and all the rest of it, and areas where basically you are going to be generally in the past going to a room that's going to be, you know, densely packed full of people in a hot atmosphere watching a great local band or a band on tour. Where on earth do those venues go from here to try and offer an experience that people have got has just been part and parcel of life, but is now, certainly as we stand right now, diametrically opposed to what one is allowed to do, or possibly going to be allowed to do.
Yeah, it's honestly, Sean, it's one of the saddest things I'm seeing at the moment, because, you know, music very much is my kind of, drug. It's a thing I love to go and do, is see live bands. It's one of my favorite things to do. Those venues are hurting. So, you know, a lot have already been lost, unfortunately. So one of the great venues in Boston where I used to live, Great Scots, closed down last week, which was, you know, incredibly sad. I spent far too many an evening in there when I lived in Boston. I know folks at Noise Pop here who own a couple of venues. They're in a lot of pain. Every single venue is doing fundraising for their staff at the moment. But that doesn't feel like it's going to be sustainable to get them through what are going to be at least for next 6 months, because I think the reality is going to be is there will be no shows until next year. I think you're seeing that now in the pattern of when, you know, shows are being rescheduled for. There's some things I've seen. I mean, you know, in Sweden, because they were very big on social distancing as their strategy over there, I'm sure you've seen the photos of shows happening there where people are literally standing 6 feet apart. They kind of got the venue laid down. It's a very odd looking experience, but it's one that, you know, seems to be one that they're trying and hasn't seemed to lead to problems so far. I saw another one in Europe where they were essentially doing the drive-in movie theater model, where it was a band on stage and they would basically broadcast by FM radio into cars for people to go and, you know, see the show. Obviously not great for a local music venue, but you know, one that was being done. And then I think you're seeing a lot of, you know, clubs now. It's like Goodram in Brooklyn, for example, has been pretty impressive at this, in just doing, you know, either Twitch channels or walled links where you'll either donate or pay money up front, and they will have some kind of, you know, DJs and stuff playing in the evening. There's things being done. There's bands now, for example, doing, you know, their paid home shows that you can go and watch online. The reality is, it feels like it's going to be a really difficult problem for the venues to solve. And, you know, particularly in places like San Francisco and New York, where the rent is incredibly high for their real estate, even if you try and look after the staff and furlough the staff, you've still got massive costs going out of the business every month with no revenue coming in. So that's just, I'm not sure what the answer is going to be there. But I look on the other side of it as well and just think about the musicians. And I think one of the things that's been forgotten about is, you know, bands nowadays, musicians make money through touring. They make money through the show funds. Mm. They make money through merchandise sales. They don't make it through the music. The music in many ways has become the trailer for their tours, and that's where they make their money nowadays, unfortunately, because people, you know, people have moved towards streaming. They're getting, literally 0.00002 cents per stream. It's just not a model that they can live on. So I think the musicians are under immense pressure, and so are the road crews, and that's the one that's been really forgotten about. And you see now a lot of fundraising going on as the folks who actually provide the support systems and infrastructure for the band to operate on the road. So I think it's even bigger than venues. I think there's a big swathe of the economy that is under massive challenge. And I just don't know what the answer can be for them, apart from trying to do things like, you know, the kind of, you know, behind paywall, you know, live streams of shows, which are not the same, but they're things that they can go and do. Those are the things that they have to try and do. But it is, you know, personally, one of the biggest things for me in terms of impact in my day-to-day life has been the inability to go out to shows. I find those things to be just incredibly cathartic and rewarding, and it's a big hole in my life not being able to go and see them. It's a real first world problem, but it's just, you know, I feel day in, you know, and day out.
I mean, on that point about, you know, the absolute vital, I mean, part, to put it, you know, to put it mildly, that those who, you know, provide and drive and create culture provide it makes life worth living, all the rest of it. If you could put them at the moment under that issue about, as you're saying, things like road crews, you know, the forgotten people, a lot of artists being forgotten people, yeah. because, for instance, they might not even sort of qualify for government help because they're not officially businesses and all the rest of it. So they've got, you know, an even worse time. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people have been talking about is we don't want to have the, I think, again, the FT talked about this. They said that, you know, amongst the biggest challenges will be preventing inequalities that the great lockdown has already compounded from being widened by the great easing. You know, there's that issue that they're saying some parts of the country have been hit hardest by the disease, which is generally cities, and not the parts that are going to be hit hardest in the long term economically, which are things like, amongst those individuals, are also going to be areas which tend to be rural or post-industrial areas. Yeah. So you're going to have that potential when the divide and the inequality gets way worse than it already was, which was already appalling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's not enough thought being given to how we come out of this in an equitable way that's good for society. I think it's a very good point that, you know, rightly we are focused on where is the immediate danger in terms of health at the moment. And that should be issue number one. But there has to be thinking around how we come out of this in a way that reduces rather than exacerbates the inequality across a whole different range of spectrums that exists at the moment. Because there is, I think, genuine danger of an unstable society that comes out of this. And that is just something that, you know, we can't allow to happen. We just can't allow to happen.
Okay, well, last couple of questions, and it's been brilliant. Thanks so much, Gareth. So I've basically, sort of positioned all these talks around and my whole sort of new abnormal ethos around three key things, so those being hope, community, and resilience, as being, you know, a positive way forward, you know, after COVID. Again, feel totally free to disagree, but just your thoughts on those. Are those, you know, the three buzzwords, or is there something that should be replacing them, or what? So hope, community, and resilience. What's your sort of broad take on that?
I think hope, absolutely, we need hope now, and we need to use this moment of absolute pain, as Arundhati Roy talked about, as a portal to a better world coming out of it. So let's use this for good rather than just being kind of momentary absolute pain and then go back to where we were beforehand. I think that would just be, you know, an incredible, incredible miss. I think community is, I think, absolutely right. I really believe there's going to be a strength in togetherness that can come out of this. I think it's interesting to watch how kind of, you know, I think just from my own personal perspective, the virtual ties I'm building with people I'd kind of lost touch with because they just weren't physically near me has increased dramatically in this time. And that is something I don't want to let go of. So I think a sense of, you know, broader community beyond your geography, an individual is going to be important, but I think also a sense of greater empathy and community of fellow men around you. And those are the people you don't necessarily know, but are other human beings, you know, on this planet, in your country, in your city, in your neighborhood. And I think resilience is absolutely going to be key. I think, you know, it's a skill that we are not particularly strong at as a society, and maybe we can learn some lessons from this. But I think there's one other thing I would add to this, which is really around responsibility and responsibility for one another, and really being aware of the potential byproducts of our actions. Often you hear of people, you know, particularly I think this is true inside Silicon Valley, of the unknown externality of them taking, you know, a certain type of action. You know, Facebook are probably best known for the kind of, you know, mea culpa of, we did not realize this was going to happen. And whether or not you did know that, you've got to think much longer and much harder about what the impact of your actions are going to be on the people around you, because we're going to be in a very fragile and unstable state for a long period of time, far longer than actually I think this medical crisis will go on for. And it's down to us to having a greater sense of responsibility to one another that will get us through this.
Well, on that note, I mean, Gareth, that was how superbly put. So we covered a lot of ground there, and I thought it was great. I mean, initially, just a couple of things there. Your initial point about, you know, the challenges is the complexity of uncertainty, talking around the issues, the importance for brands in that world to do something useful and then document it, asking themselves what is the genuine role they can play, what is the why should people believe in them. Talked a lot about issues around things like surveillance capitalism and transparency, the point about the vital issue of saving our culture, saving our artists, looking after them, and then that final point about strength and togetherness and the responsibility that that brands have, in particular, let's say, Silicon Valley brands and all those that are like them. So just to finish off, so just so everyone's totally clear, if there's, someone out there that bizarrely doesn't know how to get in touch with you and the wonderful chapter, so just let us know, where can they track you down?
Probably the best bet is that thing called Twitter. So I am at Gareth K, G-A-R-E-T-H-K.
Fantastic. So, Gareth, well, thanks very much. So, it's evening here in the UK, so presumably a lot earlier over in San Francisco. So, thanks so much for joining me. It was really, really interesting talking with you, as always.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry if I was even more rambly than normal today, but it's just the joy and the newness of actually being able to talk to someone. It's quite exciting.
Excellent. All right. Cheers, Gareth. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Sean. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.